It is with great pleasure that I welcome Malcolm Hohnlein to our studio. He is the Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. He knows, I know, how difficult it is for him to be here early Friday morning. It's difficult enough to get him on the phone early Friday morning. He knows how important it is to interact with this audience. I'm sorry, your mic was off. I'm sorry, Mr. Comedian, your mic was off. It must have been a good laugh.
That was a good one. I enjoyed it. They'll never know, but it's okay.
He knows how important.
I mean, this is what he does every Friday. He shuts off the mic when I answer the good questions, and then
that's
you don't
right.
Know.
We edit. It's publisher's right over here. He knows how important it is to interact with the audience and to hear not only from me my concerns and my curiosities about what's happening in this world, but obviously the concerns and curiosities of the people out there, everybody in our wonderful audience, and therefore every once in a while we feel the need. It sort of like builds up after a few months where we feel the need to come in, speak face-to-face, and more importantly to open up the phone lines and allow people to ask questions, really any question, whatever you want to ask Malcolm, here's your chance. I know there's some issues that people complain or suggest to me that I don't bring up enough, so here's your chance to bring up what you wish. We do mourn the loss of Rabbi Mertzbach, who was killed in this terrible episode outside of Hebron this morning. I was just discussing with Malcolm off the air how this seems to be initially a case of some type of accident where the rabbi did not realize that the IDF personnel were trying to slow down his car or wave down his car or get him to stop. And this terrible thing happens. This terrible episode happens at the hands of the IDF. And I said to you that, I again blame this on the enemy. I blame right. this on the enemy.
They have put us in a position where we have to take steps like this, or think occurrences like this happen that don't in normal societies, because they don't, have to think about what every car could bring, what every, unknown could elicit.
And I, and as terrible as this is, and who could even begin to describe what's going on there as we speak, but the imagine, and again, just. Again, I don't want the enormity of the episode to get lost, but I have to say this. Imagine the young IDF soldier who is responsible to, quote-unquote, slow down this car, whatever the procedure is, and sees that someone is violating, what he mm-hmm. felt was, an appropriate way of doing it. Now he gets nervous, like, oh, my gosh, is it in fact the enemy trying to infiltrate, or has bombs in his car, is ready to explode himself, whatever the case is. And we're talking about young kids in the Army, as you know, and the whole thing starts to, explode, so to speak. The whole episode takes off. And again, that's why all of us blame the enemy for putting us in this type of situation. Two things before. And I see already people want to ask you questions by telephone, and why not? That's why you're here. And we'll get to it in a second. But I guess I should bring up, number one, this whole Sarkozy-Obama thing. I mean, this eyewitness accounts that Sarkozy calls Bibi a liar, okay? I guess politicians have interesting points of view about their colleagues. And then President Obama, supposedly, because I don't think there's a recording of this, but President Obama in an open microphone says, you think you have it bad? I have to deal with the guy every day. What do you think of this whole exchange?
It's one of those things every politician's nightmare is being caught with an open mic. You can think of many cases, and it's happened to Sarkozy before in comments about Merkel of Germany and other instances. So he's given to making colorful comments. And what happened was that they had just finished a G20 meeting, and the president was, in fact, berating Sarkozy for voting for the Palestinian admission to the UNESCO. Mm. And Sarkozy then, with parts, obviously, that were not reported. It wasn't recorded, but it was heard by many people because the mic was on and reporters were still in the room that they had left. And they went off into a side room.
The guy in the back forgot to shut the mic.
And they forgot to take. They didn't realize the mics were still hot. And they, so they were talking. And of course, the parts they and the reporters at first didn't get it. They heard the thing, but they didn't all pay attention. And it's very strange to me that they didn't release it right away. And then some said that there was reports that they were told or had to sign something that they wouldn't release what was said. I mean, no reporter is going to abide by that kind of a commitment, right. Such a juicy thing. So it raises some questions about it. But clearly, Sarkozy has made comments in the past. The record of France of late has not been good. They will abstain at the Security Council on the vote on the Palestinian request for membership and recognition as a state. But they gave the UNESCO vote because 16% of the vote in the upcoming election are going to be Muslims in France.
Wow.
Maybe more. And he is
registered
playing to that vote.
Voters? Those they're at the point where they're there long enough and all the other stuff?
Yes, absolutely. At least 16%. Mm. And of course, you know, the number of illegals and everything else, the number is, in fact, much higher. So the sense is that he's playing to that audience. And that dictated. And the president was knocking him on their vote and saying that he essentially calling Sarkozy a liar because Sarkozy had not indicated to them, didn't tell them in advance that that's what they were going to do. And the United States was sure that all the Europeans would at least abstain or vote against. And as you know, 14 countries voted against, right, and 52 countries abstain, a point that the media misses completely. And we discussed it, I think,
right,
last week.
Sure.
That 66 countries versus 107 that voted for, but 66 countries still did not vote for it. That's a huge statement given all the pressures and everything else that they were subjected to. So the president said that, and then the president made his response that you think you have problems, I got to deal with them every day.
Right.
It was obviously an unkind comment. It was untoward. It was not appropriate. The fact is that I don't think he deals with them every day, but the well, at different levels of government, there are interactions between Israel and the United States every single day, mm-hmm, on many levels, and some of it quite positive. Certainly in the military intelligence level, it's very positive, and there's going to be this huge exercise in a few months, which is important as a message to the American people that it's not a one-way street, about Israel's importance to the United States, not just the United States' importance to Israel. And if you see some of the statements by the military lately, which was not true in some of the years under President Bush, where the military relationship, going back to Secretary Cohn, had deteriorated. I mean, it was more of a cold relationship. And I think more and more people came to realize the importance of Israel, the intel, the military devices. I mean, what's saving the lives of our guys in Afghanistan?
On this Veterans Day.
What's taking out the enemy, right, not Israeli drones, the technology, the protective gear, so many things that Israel developed and has made available to the United States troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course they use it themselves. And every day they have something new coming up in this realm. There was this past week exercises in Italy where German, Dutch, Italian, and Israeli warplanes did exercises together. They did exercises together with the Greek army not long ago. So when people talk always about the isolation of Israel, there's another side to this story.
And I want to talk more about that in a minute. I want to start our phone calls to get into the rhythm of them and to make good on our commitment to our listeners to go to them. And we have other issues we'll discuss as well. 201-209-9368, 201-209-9368. From Malcolm Honlein, live in our studio. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Malcolm. First of all, I just want to thank you for all your hard work for Klal Yisrael.
Thank you.
We appreciate it, and we thank everyone for their hard work in getting these updates out there for everyone.
Thank you.
Just want to quickly ask, in light of the aftermath of the Shalit deal, obviously we had to pay a deep, bitter price to release a lot of terrorists. But a lot of those terrorists also have American blood on their hand. I want to know if there's an effort or why isn't there an effort by in America to sort of extradite a lot of these terrorists and bring justice on that front.
That's actually a very good question, and it's an issue that some members of Congress have raised, and there are legal opinions that say that America has a right to go after or demand the extradition of these terrorists. I understand that there are some members of Congress are considering legislation towards this end. I don't want to say more because I don't want to sabotage the effort, but I think it would be very worthwhile. And even if just to put, you know, a price on their heads and let them know that they can't just wander the world freely after what they have committed.
201-209-9368, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to ask Mr. Honlein to follow up on the meeting that was supposed to take place with Joe Biden.
As you know, I saw the vice president and I confronted him over his comments. No, that was the first when these reports came out.
We're talking about Pollard now?
Yes, we're talking about his comment. First, his comments about Pollard to the group of rabbis.
Right.
Very unfortunate comments, almost inexplicable because it was he who just raised it out of the for some reason, even though Joe Biden can do that and is known for often doing
unusual
things like this, but his comments and some of the tone of the comments were really quite extreme, I think, and disturbed many people. So there was an event, the vice president, a meeting with him, and I went to him and I said, look, this is an issue that your comments are very disturbing. And then he agreed at the conclusion of this that he would have a meeting, a follow-up meeting, and we are working with them on it. We've been pressing for it, and I hope that it will, that this will happen.
201-209-9368. Malcolm Homeline is here. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen, and thank you, Malcolm, for your very enlightening updates over the year. It's can't miss radio for me.
Thank you.
But I do have to take you to task a little bit today.
Why not?
I think that you,
it was going too good.
And I think it's because you try to bring the most important Jewish and Israel-related news to the air, but I think you're missing one of the most important, if not the most important, of development in recent in the recent time, and that is the that and I know that that you're walking a fine line with respect to partisanship, but that doesn't make it impossible to make the observation, at least, that for the first time in our lifetimes, for sure, every credible candidate of a single of a single political party is demonstrably rock-solid supporters of Israel. And when I say support of Israel, I don't mean a lot about the peace process or the unbreakable bond and all that. What I mean is support for the right of Jews to build anywhere in their capital and their country. Support for the right to Israel to defend itself as it sees necessary. Support in the way that saying that Judea and Samaria are an integral part of the land of Israel. And if the Israelis want to give it away, that's one thing. But there are no rights of some Palestinian entity to this land.
And therefore, your question is?
There's my question is.
I get it.
My question is,
yeah.
You can you, again, make an impartial observation about the importance of the next presidential election and how critical it is to the survival of the state of Israel? You can leave it to your listeners to decide which way to vote in that direction, in that regard. But still, I think it's very important to be covering the depths of
right.
of the candidates and their opinions toward Israel.
Let Malcolm respond.
Absolutely. And I speak often and make appeals often about registration. And Nachum, I think since we began, we made this appeal about people voting and
right.
getting turning out and registering. And unfortunately, many in our community are not registered. Hundreds of thousands of Jews, perhaps, in New York State and the New Jersey and Connecticut region. And that could change who the president of the United States is. It determine who the candidate is. And certainly in elections and state elections, the votes are very important. You see, sometimes decided by small margins. And it's not true that you're going to get drafted or the IRS comes after you or you get called for jury duty. Those things are all of the past. So, number one, the importance of voting, I can't stress enough. I try to stress it. Second, you're right. I cannot endorse candidates. I don't want to show partiality. And you know what? It's too easy to spoon-feed people. One of the things I say constantly and over the years and when I come here for the in-person appearance is that I know what people want me to say. I know that there are often on the issues that Nachum asks about, and I'm putty in his hand in these interviews, but I want to get people to think. I don't want it to be a knee-jerk reaction. I don't want to just tell them what they want to hear. I want to force people to look at issues because, you know, you face things day to day. You're not going to hear us discuss every issue. When you look at the upcoming election, it is going to be a critical election. It's going to be critical for domestic reasons, international foreign policy reasons, and especially for the things that are of great priority to us. Now, not all the candidates. You have Ron Paul, certainly not demonstrably pro-Israel in his record. But again, I don't want to make partisan comments. I do speak about what some of the candidates say. I do talk about the actions and some of the policies that are being addressed. But I want people to look at things, to think them through, to make assessments, and most of all, in this case, to make a decision to go and vote. And I think Jews should be in every camp. We should have Jews working with candidates so that no matter who wins, we have a relationship with those people. We can't afford to isolate significant segments of the American public or of the American elected officials. We need to have relationships with everybody because we have so many issues. You can't imagine. I couldn't even take the time in that we have allotted to talk about all the things, whether it's an Iranian Jew who can't get out of the country or another endangered community, things that obviously never make the press. We never want to make the press. I would say 90% of what we do doesn't ever get to public attention.
Right.
And that's why it's effective.
And on the first, on the first part of your point, that's why you are intolerant, and I'm being kind, when you're at these public appearances and you're, why don't they just bomb this? People don't realize how irrelevant those comments are to someone like
you. And how intricate the issues are. And believe me, I feel the same way. I in my own gut and things I would like to say and things that I would like to do, but it's not constructive and it's not helpful to you. And what I want to do is to stimulate you that on Shabbos, you sit at the table, talk to your kids about these issues, have a discussion, talk to your family and your friends that don't talk in shul, talk, you know, between
kiddish,
maybe,
kiddish.
But a kiddish certainly, that people talk about issues. We have to be a community that is enlightened. We have so many hot concerns now. You saw the IA report. Mm-hmm. You all know what's going on with the Arab Spring. We've tried to be ahead of the issues each time to get people to be aware. And then they will get involved. Making a decision of who they vote for should be based upon knowledgeable thing, not a knee-jerk reaction because some guy looks good, doesn't look good, can't count to three, could count to three. That's not the critical issue. It's where do they stand on the issues? What is their gut? What do you think they will do when they're not in front of when there's an open mic and you hear the real truth?
I've said this to you many times, and you know, when I grew up, current events was a very big focus of the Shabbos table, and I'm not mm-hmm. minimizing all the other important aspects of the Shabbos table. There are more important things than current events, but making it part of it is extremely critical.
And we have good Jewish publications too now that people can read, and you get, and you have the internet. We have the DailyAlert.org. You have Jewish World Review. You have many places where you can go and get credible information. The Daily Alert gives you every day a summary of the things that we talk about. And it's that day's news. It doesn't cost anything. And if you take that and talk to your kids, if we're raising a generation that doesn't know. They don't know the history, and they don't know current events. And in schools often, you don't have teachers who can teach these things, which is
another
program.
201-209-9368. Malcolm Homeline is here. You're on the air. Sorry about that.
That's the operator's calling.
The operator wasn't happy. 201-209-9368 on this Veterans Day. Here in the United States, Erev Shabbos Parshas Vayera with candlelighting time at 4:21 on this Erev Shabbos. You mentioned JewishWorldview.com, and I just want to mention to our listeners that they continue to be a favorite of many of the country's top talk show hosts. Today, Mordechai Schiller pens a touching profile of a liberator of Dachau, now in his late 80s. You may have recently seen a now iconic photo, an almost Norman Rockwell scene that features him being saluted by a three-year-old. Read his story, learn why the war has never ended for this soldier. And in reference to Caroline Glick's column today, JewishWorldReview.com's editor writes, you knew Ms. Glick would weigh in on the Obama-Sarkozy slurs against Netanyahu, and you knew her analysis would be masterful, but she truly has outdone herself. Just two of today's offerings. Check it out, as we always recommend, JewishWorldReview.com. You're on the air with Malcolm Homeline. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to know if the attack on the atomic reactors in Iran is a real possibility. Why do people like Peres and other people talk so much about it? Shouldn't it be a secret?
That's an excellent question, and it's an issue that is debated. I was in Washington yesterday all day talking about some of these issues, and it's a dilemma because part of the tactic is to try to convince the Iranians that this is real, that there really is a military option. And for a long time, nobody was talking about it. And now, again, the president has said that Iran cannot have it, and this does talk about the military option. Some of the Europeans, the British this week, spoke about their exercises that they're engaging in preparation for the possibility of a military exercise. And most of all, the hope, I think, on the part of Israeli leaders, and coming from Paris, perhaps they think it'll have more credibility, is that they want to drive the international community to act. And the one thing that might is not Iran's progress, but the fear that Israel is actually going to do something and that will that they will not have any hand in, that this way, if the international community at least is mobilized and if they do it, and also nobody wants to see this half succeed. If it's a huge undertaking, and let me just take 1 second, Nahum, to, because it's very important. I know you're going to have many more calls where people want to know. The answer is yes, it is possible. Israel can do it, I believe. United States can do it even better because the U.S. has the resources, you know, to fire 1,000 missiles. We have aircraft carriers in the Gulf. We have other capacities in the region and many more that we could bring to bear. Israel doesn't have any aircraft carriers lately. The whole country is an aircraft carrier, but it's not a mobile one. They do have submarines that are equipped with very sophisticated items and are on patrol in different places regularly. So the option is there. The question is, what's the best way for it to happen, and how do you make sure that you don't just knock out the capacity right now, and in 6 months from now, they're back full force, you know, enriching uranium, and that would be a huge setback and only complicate the situation even more. So it has to be done in a way that really delivers a blow to this, to the thing, maybe a blow to the regime as well. And as you know, there are real differences between Ahmadinejad, Khamenei, and others about what they're doing. But nobody should write off Ahmadinejad. And if you saw the picture of him visiting some region in Iran and the huge crowds, I tell them all the time when they say, you know, Khamenei is the super leader, he is the supreme leader, all of that. But Ahmadinejad is a very shrewd guy. His relationship with the Iran Revolutionary Guard, who not only control 40% of the economy, but are really the critical balance in terms of the military power, internal, external. You have duplicate navies, you have duplicate armies, and certainly all the militia groups. But Ahmadinejad should not be dismissed, and we have to take seriously. You see the new facility they're building in Qom, which is inside a mountain. And once it's completed, it can't be penetrated by airstrikes. They can't, even with the bunker buster bombs, cannot penetrate this into this site that can do, you know, do some damage, collateral damage. We can attack other sites. And that's one of the reasons why Israel talks about the window closing. Because, A, if once places are hot, once the enrichment is hot and you have big radiation spills, that's something you want to avoid. That's why Israel had to do in Syria at that particular time, because once that reactor went hot, it became a big problem because, first of all, the radiation then goes over Israel, goes in, it's a tight region. It's not, you know, in the middle of a desert.
Damage.
Exactly. So I'm just giving you, if you think this is complicated stuff,
well,
I'm giving you one small aspect. You know, there's a 14-page addendum to the International Atomic Energy Agency report, which is really important because for the first time, this body, which is charged with monitoring nuclear proliferation, came out with an honest report. They covered, they obfuscated, they lied for Iran all along, especially under al-Baradei's leadership, who's now running for president of Egypt, and rumored to have gotten a lot of money for that campaign from the Iranians. But now we have a real report, 14 pages of detail of the technical aspects. There are three parts to the nuclear weapons program. One is enrichment, and you know that they're enriching in Natanz, they're enriching in Qom, and if you've listened to this program, we've talked about it, because I want you to understand that this is not hypothetical, that this is not theoretical. We're talking about real things happening on the ground now, and moving to the point of no return. The second part is weaponization, meaning that you take that and able to fit it to a weapon. They've mastered that, and this report shows how they've developed the trigger, which sets off the reaction, which enables them. And then the third part, I won't go into it, is the missile delivery system. And you've seen the Shahab-3, you've seen the tests, we've talked about them. I've tried to update you periodically about it because to see how far they progressed. And in, if you remember in 2007, the U.S. had the National Intelligence Agency report or Unintelligence Agency report, which distorted the reality, saying in 2003 it stopped. This puts the lie to that. And we saw the Pat Buchanans and all the others jump on it and saying, you see, they were lying, they're exaggerating, this thing stopped. It never stopped. It may have been temporarily halted when American troops were in Iraq and they thought they were going to march into Iran. But we know that they were all this time moving and progressing, and the Stuxnet helped and the elimination of some of the scientists helped. But in the meantime, we're rushing towards a closing window. And that's why Israelis, I think, and especially Paris, is talking about it because they want to get the international community focused. They want them to understand that while the United States might be able to live or think they can live with a nuclear Iran, for Israel, it's an existential issue.
You would never give a timeline on that closing window, even from your just from your own
look. The experts say that it now 2 to 2 months to a year before they can they'll be at the point. They've already enriched 20%, 70 kilograms at 20%. You need 90%, but that's only a technical thing.
And who briefs you on all this? Like you know
you
all,
do
you know all the particulars of what's happening in that mountain because of classified information, or anybody can see this in their daily.
First of all, the classified information I don't say on the air.
Right,
what I do know, and
well,
I don't know, and I
classified
that I make
stuff
it up.
You,
so
it's not you
okay.
Only come across. I mean,
no. First of all, I follow it because this is a life and death issue.
But I'm asking if this is material available to
sure.
any.
If they read the Daily Alert all along, they would know much of this. It's a question also of assimilating it. And when people glaze over when they read, you know, another development, they're all important because what they're telling you is the direction this thing is moving. Right. We warned on this program at least 7-8 months ago about the development of Qums.
Right.
Had they acted then, had actions been taken to stop that development, you wouldn't be looking now at the possibility of you know, a facility. They've already started moving centrifuges in it. They do have problems with the centrifuges. They eliminated another nuclear scientist, met an unfortunate
How
accident.
How recently?
In the last few days.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't read that anywhere.
Maybe
I'm one of those glazed people. I don't read enough, I guess.
But also, I know that over time, people have heard us talk about this for so many years. So people say already, you know, they get tired of it. You can't get tired of it.
You have
to understand what the stakes are here. You're talking about the leading state sponsor of terror. You're talking about a country violating human rights. 100 children under the age of 18 sit in Tehran on death row. They execute hundreds and hundreds of their own people. They are today persecuting Christians, Baha'is, others, Muslims who don't agree with them. You're talking about the most torturous regime of our time, expanding their influence in South America, in Africa. If you understand the true nature of the regime, you understand if you add to this the component of a nuclear weapons capacity, you understand what a threat this is to the whole world.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners, sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmam.org. Whew. Dire situation on this globe.
This is the number one issue right now.
Do you
now.
Know the first time you ever mentioned the words Islamic fundamentalism on this program? You know, we're going back almost a quarter of a century.
1988.
Right, around then.
That's
almost a quarter of a century.
And many people thought I was loony.
Well, it took 10 years for anybody in Washington to even understand what you were talking about.
Or even a prime minister of Israel at the time said to me, this is never going to be an issue in the Middle East.
Wow.
So people didn't want to hear it, but it was obvious.
Your chance to speak to Malcolm Honlein is now at 201-209-9368. You're on the air. Good morning. Hello. 201-209-9368 is the number. By the way, you mentioned this whole thing about what people say out in public and what they might be thinking. There was a threat from Russia this week. Remember, Russia threatened Israel. They better not attack Iran. It was a story.
They put markers down, yeah.
So I'm wondering, is it possible that in public Russia says to Israel, you know, you better not threaten our business partner and our friend Iran, you better not attack them, but really secretly in Russia they're saying to themselves, oh, the best thing possible would be if Israel would take out Iran. Is it possible that they're playing that game?
Yes, those things do happen. It is possible. But Russia in this case is taking the lead, at least publicly, in defending Iran. I met with the foreign minister not long ago, and he got it. We got into heated exchange because he just denied. He said there's no proof that they are developing weapons. You know, and they're entitled to have a nuclear program if other countries can have it. And then their answer, standard answer that Putin gave me already 15 years ago, was, we're closer to them than you are,
right.
So we have to worry about it. The answer is that they are making $1 billion a year of selling them these reactors, and they're looking to sell more. Those are civilian and monitored somewhat by Russia. Second, they buy off criticism of what they do to the Muslims in Chechnya. An increasing number of the military officers are Muslims in Russia, and the Muslim population in Russia is large.
In the regular Russian army.
Third, they will do anything that sticks it to the eye of the United States and tries to draw the line and show that they're the defenders of the Muslims. Fourth, they have designs on Central Asia and maybe see Iran as and reasserting the Russian Empire. Now they're talking about creating a coalition. I forgot if they called it an alliance, but a formal body, again, with the Central Asian countries who are very much afraid. And I've met with some of the leaders there and who tell me about the encroaching pressure, you know, and Putin wants to reassert the Soviet, former Soviet Union. They're looking to do that again. And unfortunately, China backs everything that Russia does because China is only interested in the energy. They want to grab up what they can. There are other interests. This has always been the soft underbelly for Russia. Turkey scares them also. We can talk about that. But right. But
I want to go back to
the Russians. You got it. The Russians are now playing a very negative role.
201-209-9368 for Malcolm Homeline. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. In recent years, Israel got its rear end kicked by Hezbollah twice in Lebanon, and Israel can't even stop Hamas from firing missiles from Gaza. How do you really expect Israel to fight a giant country like Iran with 70 million people and a huge landmass?
Because they're not going to fight 70 million people. The people of Iran do not support this. They don't want it. It is a symbol of national pride, but they don't support this regime. And this attack would not be to eliminate people, to take over the country, to do anything but eliminate the nuclear capacity. And that is a much more directed and targeted thing. And to say that Israel can't, Israel could. If Israel, there's talk now, people are saying Israel should take over to Gaza, which they could do again. The cost might be high or to sustain it over time. Israel withdrew from Lebanon. We can debate, as many are, that it was done prematurely or not the right way. And maybe even going in it was not done in the right way. Historians are writing books about it, so we won't go into it here. I wouldn't say that they couldn't do it. I think Israel could do it. They certainly could have carpet-bombed Gaza and eliminate any missiles. It's not the way Israel fights wars.
Exactly, right. And politically, they would have been destroyed. You're on the air with Malcolm Homeline. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just want to thank Malcolm for the beautiful program every Friday morning.
Thank you.
And I want to ask, as an Iranian Jew being here, I want to know what's the situation for the Jews in Iran after all this talking.
Okay. Well, first of all, the Jews in Iran are not being subjected to any special persecution. They have restrictions. You know, the schools open on Shabbos, other things that they have to go. The real issue is that the Jews don't leave. They had opportunities. We had, unfortunately, what is called the Lautenberg Amendment has ended and expired and not been renewed by Congress, which gave the ability to expedite exit for special cases, especially Jews, Baha'i, others who could be subject to religious persecution or special treatment. And we have asked for many years asked the Iranian community, and they have been very helpful, the wonderful community here in the States, trying to reach out to people there to get them to leave. And for a variety of reasons that historically have always been true and are true now, they didn't leave. And we have now emergency cases every once in a while, almost every week, actually. Young people, other people who want to leave. The process is more complicated. But for now, they are able to live their lives. They have access to food and other things. And they can even go out of the country for visits. I would hope that they would all leave permanently.
You mentioned earlier the Muslim population in the Russian military. On this Veterans Day, just a curiosity question, do you know the Muslim population of the United States military? I'm just curious.
Not in the military, but, you know, it was highlighted when we had the attack in Fort Hood, when you had some of the other attacks of Muslims against American troops. I do not know any numbers for how many.
I could probably Google it these days. You're on the air with Malcolm Homeline. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Leitner. I wanted to know two things. One is, what's happening with the third boy from Japan? And the next question is, I'm always curious to know, how did you get to where you are today, Malcolm Homeline? Like, how do you know so much?
Very good question. Go ahead, in order, go ahead.
So now I'm going to contradict it because I don't know the status of the third. I've been involved in the case, but I can't tell you right now what the status of the third boy is. I have worked with the lawyers. I've worked with the Japanese government from the beginning to try and help. So I'll be happy to find out, and I will let Nachum be able to report to you. On the second question, I have to say that it's always the Yad Hashem. I never looked for a job in my life. I did train and do my doctorate at an Ivy League school after I learned in Philadelphia in the yeshiva and decided that if I want to make a difference, and I must say the Shoah influenced me greatly, even though I was born at the end of the Shoah, at the end of World War II, and lost my grandparents and many other family members, that Jews could never be powerless again. I even once said that Jews had influence in many places, but power in none. And Jews living at the sufferance of others, not being able to determine their own fate. And I got involved from the time I was 10 or 11 in political things and saw it as a key for there to be a different course for Jewish history. And the Soviet Jewry movement, which I had the privilege of playing a key role in from almost the beginning, and came to New York to start the Soviet Jewry movement here and to work then when they started the JCRC of New York. I was the first director there, and then for the more than 25 years at the Conference of Presidents. But in each case, it was Bashert. It happened to me, and I think that imposes upon me an obligation. I told Nachum that I worked straight through the night last night to be here. But I do it because I think it's a privilege for me to be able to work on the things that I care most about, that other people, you and others who get involved, do it in addition to whatever regular jobs or responsibilities they have. And that places an achrayus, a special responsibility, and that I'm privileged to be in the position I have, but I have to earn it every day and try to justify it and to hopefully make a difference. And the way you do that is that you really have to know what's going on. Right. You can't do this based on emotion. You can't do it just based on knee-jerk reaction, because the cost and the stakes and all of the issues we're talking about are much too high for that. And so I really try to understand, and I listen to a lot of people, and I talk to experts, and I think God didn't let me. He didn't teach. I have no talents to draw, to dance, to sing, to do anything. This is the one thing God gave me the ability to do.
And one of the things that scares for that. One of the things that scares me is that, as you just indicated, you have to know what's going on, and you have to be very well educated, and you have to know your history. And it's obviously something that you're very good at. And I think an Ivy League education has a lot to do with that. And I think.
Now, the education itself, I must say, you know, it's the training is important because it teaches you how to think. But the ability, and why I anticipated in the late 80s what about Islamic fundamentalism, about Iran from the early 90s, and so many other issues, and your listeners have heard it. And believe me, it's not something I can take credit for. It's what a Kodesh Baruch Hu gives you, the ability to look at things like scientists can look
right.
at things.
No, that's why I call
other
you,
people
right.
look at things and they see it, and I don't see it. I look at it.
Right.
Here's the one thing that
right.
I can look that at
is,
and get a better
That is the reason I call you a great political scientist, but you have to let me make this point, and that is that I believe that because of the closed nature of so many of the segments of our worldwide community, instead of raising kids to explore all options and to open up their world and end up with great people in positions, you know, like you just described, like the one you're in with the ability to make changes, I think we're losing some of our best personnel to, you know, to other areas of life.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're just losing them, period, to disinterest and to apathy and indifference. You know, Moshe Rabbeinu taught us that the greatest dangers to the Jewish people are not external enemies, war, or natural disasters. It's apathy, indifference, and ignorance. Those are the three things we could not overcome. We can overcome all the other challenges. But if Jews don't care, if Jews right. are not informed, then that creates a circumstance we can't
How have. Many times have I quoted to you my father quoting Ben-Gurion? It's not mm-hmm. what the nations say, it's what the Jews do.
Exactly.
And that's what it is. All right, Malcolm Honlein is here, 201-209-9368. You're on the air. Good morning. Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. I want to know whether, Malcolm, you think that the two-state solution is a foregone conclusion. You've commented in the past on the show, and you've kind of alluded to that as a result, and I hope, God forbid, that's not the result, but I'm wondering whether that is your...
Great question. What do you say?
Well, first of all, five prime ministers have now said it, and this is not a question. People are entitled to any view, including myself and you, and you know. But this is decisions that the people of Israel, the governments of Israel, are going to make. Our job is to make sure that they're not pressured to do stuff that they don't want to do. Secondly, I don't think that today it's a foregone conclusion anymore. What we're seeing now, and this has a lot to do with the threats that Abbas is making, and it's a good, actually, point to discuss the threat in the past couple of weeks about dissolving the Palestinian Authority. Mm-hmm. Now, he's threatened to resign many times, and at least 25 times in the last 4 or 5 years. But the threat to dissolve the Palestinian Authority, and they have a plan to do it. They already have the statement drafted to announce it. What that means is that they simply will give the keys back to Israel and say, okay, you're the occupying power. Now it's your responsibility. You've got to be responsible for the security. You've got to be responsible for the health, the care, education, everything else. And the burden, the financial burden, will fall on Israel. And this is billions of dollars in addition to the manpower and everything else that will be required. But it also could have another implication, and that is they're saying, okay, let's give up on the two-state solution. We're going to go to a one-state solution, and a one-state where you have to give the Arabs, all the Arabs, the West Bank, everybody, should be part of Israel, and you have a one-state with everybody having equal rights, voting rights, et cetera, et cetera. And you obviously, the demographics and all the threats of that are quite clear. And that's why Israeli leaders who did not in the past support or advocate a two-state solution do today, because they look at what is the alternative to a two-state solution, to continuing the circumstances now with the growth of the population, with the changes in the Middle East. But I do not accept that it is a foregone conclusion anymore. One, we don't have a partner even to negotiate with. Abbas has proven that he's not interested in negotiations. He wants to impose a solution. And God forbid that that be done, because obviously it'll be very disadvantageous. We've seen various proposals now. With Condi Rice's book, we see much more about Olmert and how extensive his offer was, which I know will upset many people. Yep. But no, I don't think that there's any foregone conclusions about anything in the Middle East today. The lesson is the only thing that's predictable in the Middle East is nothing's predictable.
It's unpredictability. All right, we're going to break for Rabbi Yudin, and we will continue with your questions, everybody. We will continue with your questions. Give Malcolm a minute to breathe here.